And John has very kindly offered to step in. As well as being Director of Journalism at the Institute, John's been thinking a lot recently about the future of journalism. I guess the optimistic future and the pessimistic future. In the last year in these seminars, we've had quite a lot of pessimism. So, I don't know, I suspect John may... I don't know whether you're... Are you going to give us...
I'll give you some more.
You give us some more pessimism. So I'm counting on everybody else in the room, the kind of young, up-and-coming digital journalist in the room, to kind of rectify the balance in the discussion that follows. But seriously, I'm really grateful to John for... offering to share with us some really interesting thoughts he's been having about where journalism's coming from and where it's going to. So, John, you want to talk for what, 30 minutes or so?
Yeah, and then have a discussion.
Okay.
Thanks very much, David. I'm sorry that Robert Pickard isn't here. It's not false modesty. He is, as I think I mentioned last week when we met, he's one of the great experts on the business of journalism, and we're all concerned with the business of journalism because there isn't much business in journalism these days, or at least not in parts of it. I'm not going to read all this, but this is a kind of draft I've been working on for a long essay on the future of journalism, and I wanted to discuss elements from it and get your reaction to it, both because you're up and coming, as David said, because you work in different countries and you work in different areas of journalism. It would be tremendous now and in the future for you to engage in this question, which faces us all. What is the future of our craft? How is it changing? How does that change impact upon what we see as the mission of journalism, i.e. what journalism should be doing? And what will our place be in it? Before I start, just as you have heard or seen the extraordinary images of these Chilean miners coming out of the mine in this morning as they came up that narrow tube. I don't know how many of you know a film. It's one of the great films about journalism, though very caustic and pessimistic, if you will, about journalism, called Ace in the Hole. Anyone seen Ace in the Hole? It was one of the first films by a director called Billy Wilder, who was famous for Some Like It Hot with Marlon Monroe and Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, later on. But one of his first films he made in Hollywood was in, I think, 1951 with Kirk Douglas. And he made a film called Ace in the Hole, in which Douglas, who has been a big-time, big-city, I think, New York reporter, is fired for some misdemeanor, goes to a small town paper, which he despises, drinks a lot, looking for a way back into the big time, comes across a miner who's digging a one-man shaft outside of this town, and has been trapped. He's dug a hole into a cliff to get at, I think, gold rather than coal. The shaft has collapsed upon him and he's trapped. Douglas realizes that if he can keep him there, the story will build, and he'll have the monopoly of it because he got there first. He goes in to see this guy who is relatively well, apart from being trapped, and establishes a relationship. And he realizes that this could be a tremendous human interest story. All the big time reporters come, it is indeed true, the early television comes, radio comes, everybody comes to do the story of this one guy. The trouble is that, as far as Douglas is concerned, the reporter, is that he could be got out relatively easily. But he makes a deal with the sheriff, Douglas makes a deal with the local corrupt sheriff, that he, the sheriff, will become famous as the man who is in command of this operation if he agrees to tell this big lie, which is you can't get out the way you came in, you've got to dig a shaft down from the top of the cliff, which will take about a week. And in that week he will become famous, and indeed he does become famous. I won't tell you the ending. We have, but it's not good all round. We have viewing sometimes at the Reuters Institute, and I'll bring it in because I think it's one of these ones you should see about our profession. It's not pretty, but it's. But,
I believe it was based on the true story, partially.
Really?
I think so.
Now, well, if you can find that, I didn't know that. You may be right. If you can find it out, it would be great.
I mean, maybe it's a true story.
Yeah. Well, it just the Chilean miners thing. There's no CNN isn't paying off the miners to stay down there, so the story builds, but it brings it to mind.
Does it make you more or less hopeful for the future of journalism that there are 2,000 journalists that are grouped around this hole in the ground?
Well, it's a good question. I should come back to that.
26 BBC people.
Each of them earning at least £250,000 a year. What I wanted to start with was what I propose is a kind of a moral dichotomy in our profession. That between the high ideals, which especially in the debate and in the way in which journalism is described in America, but not only there, the high ideals of holding power to account, of being a record of public events, of investigating wrongdoings, of analyzing complex issues, making the significant interesting, all of these things with which we're probably familiar as journalists, which are said about our profession by professors of the media, by our editors, by ourselves sometimes, is on the one side. On the other side, there's this somewhat low self-image that journalists have, which is often evinced in jokes about journalism, the way in which we speak about it. There's a famous book by a woman called Janet Malcolm, who's a writer in New York, writer for The New Yorker. And she wrote a book called The Journalist and the Murderer, which is another pessimistic book about journalists, in which she begins, there's a famous beginning to it, which is that every journalist who's not too stupid or fool of himself to notice what's going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. The more pompous talk about freedom of speech and the public right to know, the least talented talk about art, and the seemliest murmur about earning a living. The book is worth a read, Journalist and the Murderer, that came out about 20 years ago, I guess, and it's the story of how one journalist followed the trial of a man accused of murdering his wife and kids, and pretended to believe his story that he was innocent in order to get the book, and then wrote a book saying that the guy was a complete bastard and deserved to get the death penalty, which he ultimately did get. So within the profession, there are these two kind of disparate elements at extremes, that we are a necessary prop to democracy, which I think we are. At the same time, we essentially market the sleaziest parts of our society. We try to get stories from people which show them in a bad light, or show their organization in a bad light by any means possible. And yet at the same time, both those who think we're a bunch of sleazebags and those who think we are democratic props probably agree that we are essential, that we actually are necessary to a democratic state, that when you go to states which are not democratic or party democratic authoritarian, then you see very often the journalism which is constrained by, most of all, by political power, but very often by corporate power. As indeed our journalism in democratic countries, in Britain, America, Western Europe, so on, is constrained by ownership. And one should not forget that when we talk about a free press, we talk about a commercial press, which has limits imposed, and perhaps more tightly imposed than at any time in the recent past by the ownership structure. We are, though, essential with the way in which we know the world, we get to know the world. There's a man called Kenneth Minogue, who used to be an advisor to Mrs. Thatcher when he was Prime Minister, wrote an essay a few years ago saying that we recognize, alas, that we cannot live without journalism. We might sometimes imagine it's merely the stuff we read in the newspapers every day, but actually journalism is a mode in which we think, a mode in which we think. It indelibly marks our first response to everything. The scholar and the professional, this is germane to Oxford, the scholar and the professional may escape it as they specialize, but the moment they step outside what they really know about, They enter the flow of popularized understanding, like the rest of us. Popularized understanding is the business that we're in at our best. That's what we should be doing, is to popularize understanding. Now, as you know, and some of you may be from countries where this doesn't apply, but for most people in so-called Western countries, which includes places like Japan and Australia, and Finland for that matter, even though Finland is bucking the trend a bit, the trend is downwards. For circulation of newspapers, dramatically in some cases, especially in America, where newspapers have closed, have cut staff dramatically. Some cases, like the Los Angeles Times, which had the most journalists, I think, in the world of any newspaper, and now has cut it by more than half. Great pillars like the Washington Post and the New York Times are look shakier than they've ever done before. And papers like Philadelphia Inquirer, Miami Herald, Boston Globe, which had, when I was a foreign correspondent, had foreign correspondents almost everywhere, certainly in the main capitals, now have none. Not just one or two, but none. And run either reports from freelancers or from Reuters and AP. So the institutional poles of our profession are declining, and declining quite rapidly. In the UK, many of you will be familiar with the UK press scene. Actually, no big national newspaper has closed. Many are losing a lot of money. In fact, probably all, I think, the dailies are now losing money. They, of course, will lie about that. But they, those who have told the truth, like The Guardian, are losing quite a lot of money. And one wonders how far it can go on. What has been often the case in Britain, as elsewhere, is that they're supported by people who want to have the prestige of owning a newspaper, like Mr. Lebedev, who is a very rich Russian businessman, former KGB operative, owns the Independent Group, Sunday Independent. And he makes a loss, but he's prepared to subsidize that, at least for now. The facts of these are probably well known. There's an OECD report recently that we discussed in a seminar we had earlier this year, which says that after very profitable years, newspapers, publishers in most OECD countries faced increased competition from free dailies, internet, multiple television and radio sources, declining advertising revenues, titles and circulation, as well as declining readership. The economic crisis, this was written, I think, last year, has amplified this downward development. About 20 or 30 OECD countries, that includes the most wealthy developed countries, face declining readership. Newspaper readership is usually lower among younger people who tend to attribute less importance to the print media. The effect of that is much discussed. But again, at the seminar we had earlier this year, together with Columbia University, we had a very distinguished professor of sociology from Princeton called Paul Starr, S-T-A-R-R, whose book, who wrote a long article which you can download from the net. He wrote it, I think, beginning of last year, 2009, in the New Republic on the effect of declining newspaper, above all newspaper readership. He also wrote a wonderful book called The Creation of the Media about 5 years ago. He wrote in this article in the New Republic that newspapers are cutting bureaus and staff that enable the public to monitor government as well as business. Some papers are laying off veteran reporters who have exposed major scandals. When they were financially strong, newspapers were better able not only to invest in long-term investigative projects, but also to stand up against pressure from politicians and industries to suppress unfavorable stories. As imperfect as they may have been, newspapers have been the leading institutions sustaining the values of professional journalism. A financially compromised press is more likely to be ethically compromised. Now, some people here, I know, are broadcast journalists. You may quarrel with that estimation that newspapers are leading in these fields. And actually, in this country, the BBC does a great deal of journalism. quite a lot of investigative, a lot of analytical journalism. And commercial television had done a lot. It does a great deal less now because it's commercial, because it can't make money out of it. So we're lucky in this country, but mostly, in most countries, including in this country, most reporters still, even now, work for newspapers. And their decline, at least in the short term, one can discuss what's going to happen in the longer term, but at least in the short term, the cutting of reporters means there will be less investigations, there will be less analysis, and above all, there will be less routine reporting of the kind that you send a cub reporter along to do the local council, or the police committee, or the garden fete, whatever it might be, the local Conservative Party having a conference. These things are no longer routinely covered, and haven't been actually for some time. And now, because their papers are closing, a good deal less. This reduction in the in circulation and viewing, this starvation that the industry is suffering, means that what had been the case, that is, that the stuff that people really wanted to read in newspapers or see on television, which then cross-subsidized the stuff that we journalists thought they should know about, is that cross-subsidization, either implicit or explicit, is now beginning to fall away. Clay Shirky, Shirky, who's one of the best commentators on American, on media issues and has a blog, which I think is called Clay Shirky, wrote a famous blog a little while ago, which is much quoted now, where he said that what had happened with newspapers was that they created an environment, quoting, where Walmart was willing to subsidize the Baghdad Bureau. Those of you who've been to Baghdad will be grateful to Walmart for paying your salary. This wasn't because of any deep link between advertising and reporting, nor was it about any real desire on the part of Walmart to have their advertising budget go to foreign correspondents. It was just an accident. Advertisers had little choice other than to have their money used that way, since they didn't have any other vehicle for display ads. Now they have a choice. Indeed, they have many choices. So Walmart no longer has to subsidize the Baghdad Bureau, and of course, doesn't. It never really meant to anyway, and now it doesn't have to. Another challenge was one which we in the Reuters Institute published quite recently. There's a pamphlet which you will see by Stephen Coleman and others. You may have seen it on the table. It's extremely worthwhile reading. And in this, Stephen Coleman, who's a distinguished professor at Leeds University and late of Oxford, who had a good deal to do with setting up this institute and worked at the Oxford Internet Institute. The Internet Institute is a resource worth visiting when you're here, because it's one of the leading internet centers for the study of the internet in the world. Stephen wrote a pamphlet with others based on focus groups, which showed that, to put it very briefly and crudely, most people don't know much about most things most of the time. Even if they watch the news or listen to the news, read the newspapers, they don't know much. And the most dramatic evidence of this was from a number of focus groups that he did in and around Leeds, which was done 2 or 3 years ago now, and it was during the period when there was the primaries for the presidential election in the States. And much in the news was Obama, a candidate, and Hillary Clinton, a candidate. Not one person in any of the focus groups knew that these two were in the same party. They were both Democrats running for the Democratic nomination. The assumption was, I mean, when people were asked about it, they didn't care much about it, but when they were forced to answer about it, they said that they were vying for the presidency, that they were in different parties. And this was in the news all the day, every day. This conformed to what many journalists and others who write about journalism say, is the kind of thing that people like to know about politics. There's a fight, there's a contest, there's somebody is going to win. And clearly, somebody was going to win, somebody did win out of that. But the stakes were not known. I mean, people knew there was a contest, but they didn't know what essentially what the contest was about. So from this finding, which surprised, I think, even them, they came to the conclusion, which we'll see in the pamphlet, again, I very much recommend it, is that there is now a large gap, perhaps always had been a large gap, it's now very evident, and possibly a widening gap between the news that about events, about politics, about business, about policies, both things that come up suddenly and things that are routine, that increasingly those who need to know, if you like, the elites at various levels, know it and are very well served. They're well served by newspapers like my own, like the Financial Times, which deals with elites, wants elites because they pay a lot of money. Popular journalism, including journalism which would regard itself, and to some extent is elite journalism, but increasingly has to do different kinds of journalism in order to survive. And that gap between, if you will, the popular and the elite is beginning to widen. That the assumptions that we were able to make 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, certainly for much of the post-war period, that we journalists that knew what a story was and knew what was significant and what therefore had to be covered, that is now increasingly under, if not under threat, at least under examination. That we're no longer able to impose what we think is the news agenda on the people who read and who watch. There's a man called Yohan Peri, who's an academic in Israel, who wrote a very good book about, called Telejournalism, who put it this way. He said, like other professionals, physicians, doctors, or social workers, Israeli journalists seem to share the perception that in many cases they know better than their clients, their readers, their viewers, what is best for them. Hence the limited importance assigned to the interests of the public by journalists as against the public interest. So journalists know what needs to be known, but increasingly people are saying, and have the means to choose what they wish to know. And that then becomes the dominant, has become one of the dominant trends now and will be in the future, that this widening gap between a journalism which is elite, serves the elites, and that which is popular. Whatever form journalism takes, whether it's newspapers, declining television, still very powerful, still by far the most popular means of learning about the world, about news and so on, the net coming up quite strongly from obviously from a low base, whatever form it takes, then that is going to be I think one of the largest issues in the public debate about journalism. It is already and will be in the future. A word finally, there's much more of this, but this will at least give you a taste, and we can perhaps discuss other things when we open it up. What do people want to know about? Well, they want to know about politics, and they want to know especially about politics, as I said earlier, when it's a contest, when it's rough, when there's a problem. At the moment, I don't know how many of you are interested in British news, but one of the things in the news at the moment is that there's a problem for the Liberal Democrats, who are part of the junior partner in the governing coalition with the Conservatives. They are now faced with, in particular, one of their senior people, who's a cabinet minister, Vince Cable, is faced with the problem of responding to a report which has recommended that university fees at universities go much higher than they presently are. They're around £3,000 at the moment. Lord Brown, in his report, has recommended that they quadruple. Other universities are talking about them doing even more than that, like including this university, which is very expensive to keep going, and may need to put their fees up to somewhere near what the elite American universities do, i.e. around about £20,000 a year. Vince Cable, as other Liberal Democrats, when they were competing for the election, said in no way were they going to ever vote for an increase in university fees. He's now part of a government which probably will increase university fees, and possibly quite substantially. So that's interesting. Everyone can understand that. It's a moral, political, personal difficulty which faces cable above all, but the party as a whole. What's, of course, much less interesting, but in the end probably more decisive, is what actually happens with university fees. People also want to know about scandal, about gossip, about celebrity. And in the last few years, the magazines and newspapers which cater to that have mushroomed. In the UK, which has got an extremely powerful tabloid press, perhaps the most powerful tabloid press in the world, even now that it's reduced, still is very powerful. The Sun sells 3 million copies a day, down from 5 million, but 3 million isn't whistling Dixie. The Daily Mirror still sells over 1 million. The Daily Mail, which is perhaps the most powerful in some ways of the tabloids, at least in its political weight that it carries, sells well over 2 million. So these are powerful, influential papers which know well what they're about. And for most of them, not the Daily Mail, but for the Sun, the Mirror, the Daily Star, papers selling up to 6 million in all, then much of what they're right about is celebrity, gossip, and sex. And what had been the content of the tabloids, say 20, 30 more years ago, which was quite a substantial amount of political coverage, indeed some foreign coverage from some foreign correspondents, has now gone in that favor. So again, these polls are further apart, the market is increasingly winning, and what we are seeing is that what people want from journalism now comes through much more clearly. And just with something we've been talking about with David and others, and is very clear, I think, as an example, in the European Union. The European Union, as you know, is a collection of states who have come together, of West European, now Central, even East European states, depending on how you define these, are now part of the European Union. They, by being part of that, they pool a very large part of their sovereignty. They have to obey by the directives of the European Union. They have to bring them into their own legislation, then becomes law of the land in all of these countries. The European Commission, the European Parliament, the European Council, all of these are in different ways powerful, influential bodies. The reporting about them in most states, not all, but in most states, is abysmal. Very little is written, even less is broadcast. The amount of knowledge that people have about the European Union is extremely low, much lower than, as polls show, much lower than their knowledge about their own parliamentary or political system. Many people, at least in this country, I think most people in this country, don't know who their member of the European Parliament is. I mean, this country may be, because of its history of being skeptical about Europe, an outrider, but my belief is that it's not much different in France, Germany, Italy, Holland, etc. Now, in the course of the European Union's existence, no journalism has arisen which can routinely cover the European Union's activities. There is journalism. There's a press corps in Brussels of around 1,000 people. Some of them are not resident there, but they're accredited, or 1,000 or more people, journalists are there. Many of them are highly skilled. They know very well what happens. They're in a place where there's a whole concentration of politicians, officials, think tanks, and so on. So it's quite easy to gather information. It can be a bit obscure, but often it's not. It's relatively open. And yet we don't get much of a narrative, day by day, week by week narrative of what happens in this very powerful institution, which affects the lives of every one of us in Europe. sooner or later, something that Europe does will affect us. And we get scandals, we get expense scandals, we get battles, especially in the last couple of years, around the so-called Lisbon Treaty and new people at the top. But we don't get much of an understanding because it is assumed by news editors, who one assumes know what they're talking about, though most reporters would say that news editors don't know what they're talking about, say that Europe is dead. Anything, any headline, any bulletin which starts with Europe, any headline with Europe, immediately switch off. People just don't read it anymore, and hence there isn't much European news. So in a way, we failed. We journalists, as a whole, have failed to make what is undoubtedly significant, the workings of the European Union, interesting for people to read. And that, I think, calls for some reflection. I'll leave it there. There's an awful lot more. This is a lot of beast, but we may come back to some of the other things in discussion.